You're listening to the Exploring Research Careers podcast, the podcast that talks to people about their research careers and also explores personal histories of those who support researchers. In this episode of Exploring Research Careers podcast, I speak with Dr. Liz Elvidge. She talks to me about the early days of her postdoc experience and how her interest in academic and researcher development began and grew. She talks to me about her work in Heriot Watt and Cambridge universities, and she ends by providing advice and guidance to PhDs and postdocs researching today, based on her extensive experience through her role as director of the Postdoc and Fellow Centre at Imperial College London. You're very welcome to this episode of Exploring Research Careers. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Liz Elvidge from Imperial College London. There's been a pattern emerging in relation to how we kind of start off and kick off the podcast, and it's around the PhD journey, depending on the guests that we have on. Liz, would you talk us through your decision process or how it was that you decided to embark on a PhD?
If I'm really, really honest, it was all to do with a boy. So there was this boy that I really fancied who was did the same degree as me. And I was hopeful that we might go out. And what he said to me was that he thought I should do a PhD. So what I really thought he was saying is, do a PhD, we'll do our PhDs together, and then we'll go out. But actually, he really wasn't saying that. What he was really saying is, go and do a PhD. And I discovered that because I applied for a PhD at UEA in Norwich and was offered it. And then he applied for one in Sheffield. So if you look at the map, Norwich to Sheffield is nowhere close. And he really wasn't saying, shall we go
There's out? Two ways to take that. One is, you're so clever and intelligent, you should do a PhD. Or there's another way to take it. How did you take it?
I suppose I hadn't thought about that. I think it was just that I just really liked him. And, you know, when you're very young and emotions can do the decision making for you. So I got this PhD studentship at UEA in Norwich. So it was glacial geomorphology of Northern Scotland. And I think, to be honest, one of the things I really wanted to do was I wasn't finished with the learning. So with my degree, the bits that I really enjoyed was doing the dissertation and exploring things and experimenting. And so I really enjoyed that bit. And I just thought I wasn't finished with that. So I got off the PhD. It was industry funded, which I think, again, if I was looking back now, was a little bit of a mixed blessing, because any reports or papers couldn't be published because it's commercial in confidence. But the upside was there was very clear audit trail. So it made me very, very organised. So that was the upside to it. And then the other side was that it was my field area was the whole of Northern Scotland. And so I had fantastic field work. And when I had my viva, the external said it was quite nice to see very big picture geomorphology, because there'd been a bit of a trend to sort of look at things on a postage stamp. So all in all, it was that. But I really enjoyed it. I love doing field work.
And when you were at that point, kind of coming up to the end or even through it, were you thinking, I think I'd like a career in academia? Or were you thinking, I mean, you mentioned it was funded by industry. Were you thinking, I'll probably go into industry? What were you thinking?
No, I was thinking very much academia. I really enjoyed it at UEA. And I think I was surrounded by people who had done PhDs and were doing postdocs. So that was very much my circle. So my first postdoc was literally given to me in the corridor. So I was walking down the corridor and my future PI said, oh, you've worked in Northern Scotland, so peat bogs pretty much, and would you like to work in the desert in Egypt? And I said, yes, please, thank you very much. And that was it. I think we barely stopped walking.
Wow.
And so I got a NERC-funded postdoc, so Natural Environmental Research Council. And I have to say, they were the days when you could put in for a grant. It was completely speculative. It was, we're going to go to Egypt, we're going to work in the desert, we're going to collect all these samples, and we're just going to see what we find. The project was dating the opening of the Red Sea. But it was one of those really nice projects that we'll just see what we find out. I mean, it just would not be funded now. It wouldn't even get past first post.
Okay.
So that was my first post.
How long were you there for? How long was that contract for?
Oh, gosh, two, 2.5 years.
Okay, because you mentioned that it was around this time you did become interested in research or development. What was happening, or what were you seeing that kind of sparked that interest?
Yeah, so when I was doing my PhD, we had the opportunity to teach undergraduates, which I enjoyed. But then there was also the training of those people to teach undergraduates, so supervisor training, and it was that bit that I became very interested in. So how do you teach people to teach? And so I moved on a bit more in my PhD to do that. And then when I was doing my postdoc, I then hooked up with what's now the Centre for, I think it's Educational Staff Development, and worked with them about putting together training programmes for people who will be teaching. So that was the sort of the shift. So I often get asked, how did I go from glacial geomorphology and magnetostratigraphy to doing the job that I'm doing now? And it wasn't a sudden shift. It was while I was doing my PhD and postdoc, there was this underlying theme of me doing developing researchers as well. So it wasn't, there was a sort of two paths to it.
How many contracts, postdoc roles did you have?
So I had the first one with NERC, and then I got a lectureship. So I got a lectureship in a further education, higher education college. And that was that was the pinnacle. You know, I'd got to where I wanted to be. I wanted to be an academic, to be a lecturer. And that was a real thump of reality. So it was awful. It was because UEA and the school I was in was very academic, very research focused. And then when I got this job, it was very, very teaching focused. It was a struggling FEHE college. What attracted me was the HE side, but it was really FE. And so what was...
So FE is further education, just for those who might be listening who might not know those terms.
Further education, higher education. So okay. What was really difficult was that they were incredibly short-staffed. And it got to the point when if someone was off sick, there was very high staff sickness, they would just ask anyone to cover the teaching. And so when I was being asked to cover pretty much like nursery, training of nursery nurses, 16-year-olds, I was like, this is ridiculous. This is not what I'm here for. So the college advertised and appointed 4 new lecturers. I was one of them, and we all left within a year. So it was a real turning point. I have to say, though, I have never laughed so much, because it was hilarious, because it was so awful. We had this gallows humour, and we just laughed all the time, because it was like, I can't teach nursery nurses, but it doesn't matter because that's what I'm being asked to do. So it was quite a bold move, because
you're giving away the secrets of the UK education system here.
That's a long time ago. It's moved on. So it was a very bold move, I have to say. And I look back and think, gosh, would I make that decision again? Because I didn't have another job to go to.
Okay.
But then what I did do is I hooked back into UEA, into the staff development, and said, could I do some ad hoc training, again, of PhD students who were teaching?
And how did that happen? Did you have a proposal ready for it with classes laid out? Was that a conversation over the phone? Like, it sounds very, you know, casual.
Yes. No, I mean, the head of what was then staff development, I worked really well with her. And so I sort of approached her and said, look, I've resigned. I'm not working. And she, the two of us put together, I think it was 4 3-hour sessions. And we designed it together, but I delivered it. And so that's how it happened. So it was so talking about networking, and that was one things that I'd kept in touch with her, got on really well with her, and it was something that we were both interested in. So then what happened was there was a fund called the Enhancement of Learning and Teaching. This was a long time ago. And so she put in for a contract to appoint a postdoc, which was me, to develop a whole training program about teaching. It was called Developing Postgraduate Teaching Skills in the Sciences.
Okay.
So we put together this program, and I think this was probably a real career break for me. So that, I think it was a 2-year contract. And we developed all these materials. But the big thing was, because the way the fund was that we could develop materials, but we couldn't sell them. And so the deal was that people could have the materials, and then they got me free for a day
to talk
about the materials. And that was a real break point for me. So, because then I travelled all around the UK training people on how to use these materials. And so in terms of a break point of networking and really getting into that sector, that was really significant.
Okay. And you stayed there for 2 years?
2 years, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And just thinking about support of line managers and PIs, my PI for my first postdoc, very, very academically driven. And basically she said, don't do anything else. You have got to just stay in the lab. Don't do anything else. But the PI for my second one, she was very much, this is a fixed term contract. It can't be extended. It's a fixed pot of money. Do everything you can to move on to the next steps.
Okay.
And to be honest, that's worked much better for me. So because my first PI sort of dangled extensions and it was all a little bit nebulous, whereas the second one was, it ends on the first, was it end of August 1999? And I knew that it was going to end. And so what that then helped me to do was to aim for applying for jobs after the end of that contract.
In terms of that research or development role, were there lots of jobs? I mean, it kind of seems like you almost kind of maybe started this or were at that start of this kind of profession. So what happened then in terms of moving on from that role?
There was two jobs that I applied for. So one at York University and then one at Heriot Watt University. And they were both not so much research and development roles, but they were staff development roles. And so that was what was particularly interesting. And again, you know, you learn from these mistakes. So these were the days when you put in paper applications. So on, you know, nice, thick paper, and you typed them, but you know, handwrote them and things. And I made a mistake. And so the cover letter to the Heriot Watt job, I put into the York envelope. And so
thank you for admitting this.
It was like, oh my goodness, talk about embarrassing. And so I was quite confident I'd get shortlisted for the York job because I knew people there and I thought, yeah, I've got all the experience. And I didn't get shortlisted. I did get shortlisted for the Heriot Watt job and I got it. So that was all fine. And then 6 months later, I met someone from York at a conference and they said, oh, they said, you're Liz Elvidge. And I was like, yes. And they said, oh, the reason why we didn't shortlist you, and this is harsh, the reason why we didn't shortlist you is if you were that careless to put in the wrong letter, what would the quality of your work be? Oh, whoa, that hurt.
Yeah.
But quite right. Quite right.
Yeah.
Absolutely quite right. So was at Heriot Watt for 18 months and then did some work. I was also doing some work at Cambridge University and then got a job at Cambridge University, and I was head of academic staff development. So again, much wider than the just researcher staff development. Mm,
yeah. I'm going to just move just slightly.
Yeah.
It seems there's a lot of competition now in researchers, you know, the research area. It's just so, I mean, you're saying, you know, you put in your grant, probably wouldn't get as far as the first hurdle now. And I know that you've written this book, you know, What Every Postdoc Needs to Know. Sometimes it seems that researchers are encouraged, you know, they have a series of postdocs and they're encouraged to take a contract. But like, how do they discern which is the one for them versus wanting to stay on the research track? Like if they're offered one and they don't think it's an appropriate one or one of good standing or whatever, what's your advice for that?
Oh, gosh, I think that's really, really hard because there's the day-to-day decision of paying the rent, of, you know, buying food, and then there's the longer vision, is this going to be good for me? Is this going to further my career? And I think one of the reasons why I've stayed and love working research development is that for people it's the sort of perfect storm of challenges in their lives. And so you've got young people, they're probably settling down, having families. So all that impacts on the decision about, should I take this contract, which I'm not entirely sure about, or should I take that one? And when I gave up the lectureship, my husband worked, and so I could do that. You know, for a short time I could do that. So I think it's more thinking about analysing the job, and if it's the only one there and you need to pay the rent, then I would take it. But at the same time, don't then lapse into this will just have to do, is at the same time have a parallel process where you're looking all the time for other more appropriate jobs. So I think it's a really hard question, that.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to, I wouldn't advocate anyone starving because they're not going to get the perfect job.
Yeah. You highlight in the book, What Every Postdoc Needs to Know, again, that a postdoc isn't a career. Would you expand on that for people listening?
Yeah, so I know it's not welcome news for a lot of people, because I think there's a whole group of people that get into research and do postdocs and they love it. I loved being a postdoc. And when I was working in Egypt, I loved it. It was such a simple life. I used to get up, be in the desert for 12 hours, collecting samples, have something to eat, go to bed. I absolutely loved it. But the way that the funding is that it's all on fixed term funding. And the harsh reality is, if you're a postdoc for a very long time, you become very expensive. Two, you're capped, your salary gets capped. And three, it's still very precarious. So you're still reliant on the success of your PI. Now, most PIs are absolutely phenomenal, but you're still relying on that every couple of years. And the economics now is that when I first started out, there were things like staff researchers or like technicians that had been postdocs and had these sort of permanent roles, but those are very, we certainly don't have them at Imperial. And so I think people can get stuck. And so when I say it's not a career, it's a stepping stone to something extraordinary. And I think do the day job, but also be thinking, what is the next step? And it's that, the nub of that is really important. So
yeah,
it's the next step. But when I meet, very rarely now actually, but if I meet up with postdocs that have been postdocing for 10 years, there have been so many opportunities they've missed. And I'm my heart goes out to them. So I don't think it is a career, but I do know that's not a welcome message.
Yeah. It can seem from reading the book at times that you feel sometimes researchers don't tend to take ownership of their careers. Have you noticed that happening, or how do you respond to that?
Well, it's interesting. I think I've been at Imperial, this month, 13 years now. And I think our messaging to the postdocs at Imperial has been very clear. So your career is your responsibility, and they know that. Lots of other places, I think there's still this very complex relationship between the PI and the postdoc. And I think that many, not all, but many postdocs still feel their career is their PI's responsibility. Because actually it's their PI who's going to get them, if they get another grant, he's going to get them the next job. And in the book, I think it's chapter 5, I talk about the complexity of the relationship between PI and postdoc. But ultimately, it's the postdoc's responsibility. Their career is their responsibility. And also, I would never want anyone else responsible for my career. You know, I want to be liberated to make my own choices and decisions. So, but again, I think it's a message that people miss. And I think also, if you've been in the same university, so you do your undergraduate degree, your master's, your PhD, and your postdoc, you may have been working with the same people for 6-7 years, and there is a reliance there. There is an assumption there that they're responsible, but they're not. It's the postdoc's own responsibility.
How have postdocs responded to that? I know you say that the postdocs in Imperial, they know you're giving a very clear message, but when you go on the road or you've been speaking with other university postdocs, how do they respond?
I've had some very interesting reactions. I've had some real light bulb moments. Famously, I gave a talk at, I won't tell you which university, but anyway, it was a talk. And I said, you know, your career is your responsibility. It's not a career. And this guy stood up and shouted at me. And he said, I've been a postdoc for 15 years. I demand a permanent job. And he literally shouted. And so that did get calmed down a bit. But I haven't had that reaction from Imperial people ever, I think. And I think sometimes it's really upsetting you know, when if you're really straight with people and say you've been a postdoc for 10 years, so you've missed out on fellowships, you've potentially missed out on lectureships, then there's nothing they can do.
Yeah.
It's very, very harsh. It's very
unless it was to come around again and they caught it that time.
Yeah. Yeah. It's I think it's really, really hard. And people
But you mentioned though in the book that having too many postdocs now is damaging and that people tend to look negatively on it at this point. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I think so. What I always talk to people about when they've done one postdoc and they want to do another, the first thing I say to them is, what is it going to give you apart from salary? At the end of your second postdoc, is your CV going to be dramatically different, or is it going to be more the same? So, is it actually you're not building on any skills? And then I say, is that a good decision then? So you're just going to be doing same old, same old. So I think the other side of it is, if someone's been a postdoc for a long time, they want to stay in academia, the academia that's available to them is lectureships. And if they've been a postdoc for a long time, they are very unlikely to have been writing independent papers. They can't bring in their own money. They may have been doing a little bit of teaching. So in terms of applying for a lectureship, that they're sort of brilliant on the research side, but weaker on those other sides. And there's not much you can do to make up for that.
In the book, you highlight how to get the most out of your postdoc. And you've probably just spoken about that in terms of if one contract is going to be dramatically different. But highlight it in maybe some points how people can get the best out of their postdoc contract.
Yeah. So I think being a postdoc is fantastic. So, you know, you've got most people have quite high degrees of freedom. You've got quite high degree of freedom on your diary and time and stuff. And, you know, I look at my diary now and I would love that degree of freedom. But I think the other side of it is the development opportunities are extraordinary. I mean, at Imperial and lots of other places, you know, the postdocs have 10 days a year to do professional development. They can get involved with masses of stuff. So they have more development opportunities than any other staff group. So if they want to be involved in like an Athena Swan committee, they want to set up monthly seminar series, they want to do some shadowing, they want to do a bit of entrepreneurship. I mean, there are so many opportunities. And, you know, I think do a day job, but grab all these other things. I mean, they're so exciting. You know, grab them all so that you're not just seen as a sort of ivory tower researcher, that you've got all these masses and masses of other skills.
So I suppose that's what you see successful postdocs doing. And yet, I suppose my experience is that, you know, I've had conversations with people and they're doing that. And then these next positions are elusive. They're not there, or that lectureship is maybe not available. What happens? I suppose it's such a tough road as well, because they're doing the day job, but then there's all these other. And if they want to have a relationship, or, you know, they're starting a family or trying to get a mortgage. Yeah. It's a huge, it is a very tough road.
Yeah, I think it's a really tough road. And I think that the ones that succeed, you've also got to be tenacious. You have to be able to deal with failure and keep going. But also know when to stop keeping going and also get support. So obviously it's my job, but, you know, sometimes people, they're making the same, not realising it, but they're making the same mistakes. So occasionally I see someone who, I think they've got great CV, they may have got fellowship and they're not succeeding at either getting interviews for lectureships or succeeding at the interviews. And so for me, I would always say get some expert advice. And so I had someone recently, they'd applied for about 3 or 4 lectureships, they were not getting them. And I thought, that's really odd. They were a good candidate. But what they'd done is it's a technique. They just hadn't learnt the technique of writing good applications. So basically they were cutting and pasting. And I know to my detriment, it's not a good idea. And so I coached him through and said, don't cut and paste, because I can spot a cut and paste job. Let's look at this lectureship and go through that process. And he did get shortlisted, and then he did get it. So some of it is, it's not about confidence. It's actually about learning the technique and learning the technique of writing good applications, learning the technique of being good at interviews. So there was another guy I was working with and he was getting interviews but wasn't getting the jobs. And again, his CV was really good. I couldn't understand it. And then when I met with him, it was about a couple of years ago in November, and he was wearing shorts and a T-shirt. And I thought, okay. And then said, is that what you wear for your interviews? And he said, yeah. I said, well, you're never going to get one. So, and so he went and bought a suit. He asked me if I'd go shopping with him, but I said no.
How did he respond in that moment of you saying you're not going to get one because of what you're wearing?
But what he said was, he said, he was maths. He said, my maths will speak for itself. I said, no, your maths isn't speaking for itself. What you're saying is you disrespect the whole process. You're turning up in shorts and T-shirt and you're disrespecting the panel. And what they're looking at is they're looking at you thinking, not your maths is great, is thinking, if you're so willing to disrespect that process, what would you be like in an exam board as a future colleague? What would you be like in some other work process as a future colleague? If, you know, if you're disrespecting it at that point, then you've got nightmare all over you. So anyway, so he bought a suit.
Okay, interesting. That probably leads kind of onto our next question, because you've written in your book about careers beyond academia. Anybody's looking for a job kind of goes through the whole regime of technique and applications and everything. First of all, can you highlight what you say in the book about careers beyond academia? Because there is this kind of narrative around potentially failing academia if you move into industry or move into a different sector, which, I mean, I know I've spoken to a couple of people on this series. They're just so happy because they're very fulfilled. Their skill set matches perfectly and they're on a really good wage.
Yeah.
So can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I think one of the things that people find a challenge is that they're used to what they do in academia. And in their postdoc. And when you're saying careers outside academia, they mentally make this leap from, you know, working in the lab to sort of being some entrepreneur in some company that designs something they've got no experience with. Their concept is it's such a big leap that they're not going to be able to make it. And so what I talk about is think about people that are still, so I'm still in academia, but I am not a researcher, but pretty much I do everything apart from, I'm not referable, but apart from that, I do pretty much everything that a lecturer does. And so I think it's thinking a bit more creatively that if you've got a very tight definition of academia, which is carrying on doing your postdoc, beyond academia, there's so much very close to that, that you can stay in academia, you can do stuff that does align with your skill set. So I actually got an email from someone yesterday who had, she went through a whole trauma about, you know, was she a failing academic and things, got a job in industry, is now director of research. She said, oh, you know, I've gone over to the dark side. She said, it's the best decision I've ever made. She said, it's just brilliant. And she said she wished she'd made it earlier. She's going to come back and talk to postdocs at Imperial. So I think one of the challenges with the postdocs is that they are, that, you know, the brightest they are in the land, they've got the most extraordinary skill set, and I think for many of them the world's their oyster, and the challenge is that there's so much they could do, it's hard to make that decision. But the majority of them don't see those opportunities. They just see, I've got this narrow skill set, which isn't actually that narrow, and that's all I can do.
And I think the investment piece as well, they've kind of invested so much in this pathway that there's a fear of, like, what have I been doing all of these years? Why am I going to leave it now?
Yes. And I think sometimes the PIs are the worst for that, because some of the comments I hear from the PIs is, you know, exactly that, you know, why have you been doing this last few years? You failed academia. And I think that's really unacceptable. Is that it's about knowledge and it is about skills. So if you project manage your PhD, you can project manage.
Yeah.
So it's about translating those.
And I've spoken with employers who really value the skill set that they have. I mean, they just are ready to lap them up, you know?
Yeah.
And I just wish postdocs and researchers could realise that, you know? And I think people are more and more now, with the likes of your book coming out, it's out a few years, and different conversations. But I think there's an emotional aspect and then that practical piece of actually having to kind of, okay, I'm going to do this now. I'm going to have to lift myself from this area to another. And I think that extreme thought process happens rather than, because I was talking with someone just myself last week, and their area is qualitative research around mental health. And she's kind of really wondering, where would she ever fit? But I was kind of saying, you know, you can move that just those skills. It doesn't have to be that content, just the skill. And that opened a whole other conversation her whole face changed.
Yeah.
And it was like something had happened, you know? So I kind of feel like, because the researchers that I have known are totally amazing. You know, they have such a passion, and I just wish that they realized other people are really eager for them to share their skills.
Yeah. They are really. I mean, the number of times I get contacted by a postdoc who's moved out of academia and says, look, we're desperate to recruit these people. You know, can I advertise it for them? Because they want that skill set. They want that hardworking, you know, eye for detail, driven, focused. They want all of that.
Yeah. So I suppose we're coming up to kind of the last part. And I'm curious to know what advice that you would have for PhDs initially, and maybe then we'd talk about postdocs. But PhDs, given your own unique reason for taking on your PhD.
Yes, we never did that together. Yeah, oh well. I have to assure the listeners that my decision making is a lot better now. a lot less emotionally driven. So I think with a PhD, and I've done this with a lot of PhD students coming to the end, is ask themselves really blunt questions. Why do they want to do a postdoc? And if they can't answer that, then they need to be thinking about what that means if they can't answer it. So if a postdoc is more of the same, it just gives them another, not dismissing the salary and everything, it just gives them another 2 to 3 years of same old. And I know this is really hard, and it's really hard to make pause that point. But I see a lot of PhDs, and especially if they've done really well, and you know it's a big lab, and you know it's all cozy, and they can just drift into being a postdoc, and then before they know it, you know, 6 years down the line, they've not made any decisions. Mm-hmm. So I always encourage PhD students: what is it you want from a postdoc? What is it going to give you, apart from the salary? And, you know, where is it going to take your career?
And what advice would you have for people considering a PhD? Because I suppose some people I've spoken to, they've never really thought about what they're going to do after that. And some of them have said, the subject I was involved with, it was just, I couldn't leave it. It was just too interesting. I loved it too much. That's brilliant. But for people, I suppose sometimes I've heard people, I didn't really know what else, I didn't have anything planned, you know. And I said, don't do a PhD because you don't know what to do next.
Yes.
You know.
Yes, because the glory of a PhD and thinking, you know, at the end of this, you can be called doctor, well, you've got an awful lot of very, very long, boring days to get there. I mean, really long, boring days. So funny enough, I'm actually coaching a friend's daughter who actually is going to be interviewed on Friday for a PhD studentship. And we did a sort of a mock interview yesterday. And that's the question I asked her: why do you want to do a PhD? And she was great. Straight in there, she said, I've been doing whatever it was for a dissertation, but there's so much more. And I want to use these skills. I want to extend it to a different area. And she'd got her 3 years mapped out of what she wanted to do, the things, challenges, the risks. I mean, she's really, really on it. So I think, you know, we all at some point in our careers, I think, drift into something. But I think particularly now, because of COVID and job situation, is people are, I've heard lots of people doing masters, going, you know, students going on to masters because it just gives another year out of the job market. And so I wonder whether that's going to impact on the PhD student. But I think you're absolutely right that to think carefully about what it is, you have to be interested in it because it is a lot of drudgery. I mean, you know, I used to spend hours in peat bogs, you know, and hours. And it wasn't something, you know, when I'm in them up to my knees in peat, I wasn't thinking this is going to get me a PhD. I'm thinking I'm cold, wet, tired.
In terms of the people that you've seen move on, whether they've moved from postdoc into industry or they've moved into a lectureship and they're moving up, what are the attributes that they have? Because sometimes I think, I was talking with some researchers last week and I said, be fluid, be open to opportunities, shake your shoulders and let things come to you. Yeah. What do you say?
Because I've been at Imperial a while now, is that I'm now watching people progress.
Yeah.
And people who were postdocs have got fellowships and then they're applying for lectureships. And I have to say, it's lovely to watch that. And I think a key characteristic, one is, as I said earlier, is tenaciousness.
Yeah.
I think two is, again, is having a very clear vision, but also being flexible. So if you get knocked back onto something, pick yourself up and think, right, okay, I can carry on in this area or maybe just flex it a little bit. And I suppose just be very clear about what's needed. And if you don't know what's needed, is to ask. So I've got a lovely example of someone who was a postdoc when she came on my first ever residential at Imperial. And she applied for a couple of fellowships, didn't get any, and then applied for a big EPSRC fellowship and got it. And so she phoned me and I said to her, you know, I think you should go out onto Exhibition Road and tell every second person that you've just got this £800,000 grant. And she said, do I really think she should do that? No, that would be the shortest grant ever. But she's just kept going. But also what's extraordinary about her is that there's this whole culture about don't keep, for women particularly, don't say yes to everything, don't say yes to everything. But what she's really, really good at is she might be asked to do something and she always analyses it. Is this, am I just being dumped with a whole load of rubbish stuff, or is this a real opportunity? And if it's a real opportunity, what I will do is I will manage that opportunity and say, yes, I'd love to do it, and this is when I'll be able to do it by. So there's a real awareness of movement of opportunities. So I think that's what I think. One thing I would say is, again, being flexible and looking at things, but where I see people flailing around a bit is when they spread themselves too thinly and they're sort of a bit of a magpie, you know. So, oh, that's shiny, and it's too thin, they lose their way.
Okay. I think it's interesting what you say about her managing these opportunities. I remember speaking with someone and they had sat on interviews in their department and the email came around the following year and asked if they would do it. And she was talking with a colleague and they had said, I'm not doing that this year. I did it last year. And she said, oh, well, I was going to do it this year again because I wanted to help and I wanted to do this. And they take up a lot of time. Yeah. And the person had said to her, I've done it once. It's on my CV now. I've ticked that box and now I'm open for something else. Yeah. And she was really surprised at this and that, I guess, to be strategic about it. No, I've done that bit. Now I move on to something new so that I have something else to put on my CV. And I think sometimes people can be encouraged to do these extracurricular things. But as you say, they don't add something new to their CV. It's the same thing again. Yeah. And I think people have to be really careful of that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're right. I think it also depends on the position that you're in. So I'm on a lot of interview panels, and how that's helped me is the networking. So being on lots of interview panels, it means I know all the heads of departments. I do understand that. Say I've done it once, it's on my CV, I don't need to do it again. And I think that's very worthy. That's definitely worth doing. But sometimes it's worth looking back at it. So, okay, it's on my CV, but what if I did it again? What other things am I going to gain from that?
Yeah. And I guess having that awareness around, can I suppose, play with this a bit and get the most out of it?
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I mean, a couple of years ago, I did 6 days of interviews for one of the faculty, and there was a core of four of us, and then other people came in. And actually, the networking and the impact of that has been extraordinary. So again, I think just looking at things very carefully.
Yeah, yeah. Can I ask you the final question? What have you learned over the years, Liz?
Oh, gosh, what have I learned?
You mentioned just briefly there about, you know, particularly women in academia. Is there anything you'd add about women in academia? Or
so a particular interest of mine has been supporting women. One of the things I've learned or has been a theme throughout my years is just how women's confidence has such a big impact on their ability to succeed. And I think one of the problems is that it sort of becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, you know, is that if I apply for something and I don't get it, then I'm a failure. Whereas the guys are like, OK, I'll just go on to the next thing. So what I've learned is women, this isn't negative, but need and should get a lot of support because the gender inequality is still there. So yeah. I still find it extraordinary, the different ways people write. So one of the things I can spot the gender of a CV within a couple of seconds. I can also spot the gender of, so I've been doing bits of work on this, on references. So the gender of the person whose reference it is about. So So men to men, men to women, women to women, women to men. And so we've done some analysis of that. So one of the things I've learned is just be really careful of the words. So references from men to women, the women are worthy, you know, they're lovely to work with, they're delightful. Men to men, they're world leading, you know, extraordinary. And so I think that's probably one of the big things is actually the words we use. Okay.
Wow, that's really interesting.
Yeah. It's a really absolutely fascinating piece of work.
Okay. And is there somewhere we can get that? Is that available?
Yeah, we're working on it and it should be on the website soon. I'll send you a link. If it's open access, I'll send you a link.
Brilliant. Great.
So the thing I've learned is just, I suppose, the reason I've stayed in this area is because I love working with researchers and I love observing their exploration into their careers and their decision making. And so for me, that's why I've stayed in it. And the extraordinary achievements from some of them when they've started from really quite a, you know, maybe an uncomfortable place. For me personally, it's so rewarding. You know, it's so rewarding when I get an email like yesterday saying, thanks for your help. That was the best decision I ever made.
Wow. Liz, thank you so much for your time and for your generosity today. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Pleasure. Lovely to see you, Linda.
We've come to the end of this episode of our podcast, Exploring Research Careers. If you like the podcast, maybe you want to tell your friends and colleagues or anyone who you think might get benefit from listening to the conversations. You can follow the podcast on Twitter at @Eeyore_careers, where you can find new episodes as they're released. In the meantime, thanks for listening and take care.